Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we explore a secret world of migrants, human smuggling, and trafficking. Then, what makes a social movement sustainable and successful in the 21st century? Migrants leave their country in search of safety or a better life, but many are abducted, enslaved, or disappeared, never to be seen again. With us is award-winning journalist Oscar Martinez. He followed migrants from Central America into Mexico on their quest for better lives or safety. Oscar Martinez documented the harrowing tales of abductions, forced labor, sex slavery, and disappearances in his book, The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging the Narcos on the Migrant Trail. Welcome, Oscar Martinez. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with how you did the research for this book. You had to physically go onto the so-called migrant trail and take the same transportation that migrants are taking and really face some of the same circumstances in a way. How did you yourself stay safe?
First of all, thank you for the interest in that topic, in that tragedy of thousands and thousands of Central American migrants who crossed Mexico without papers. I started the work on the road in 2008. I arrived to Mexico in 2006, in May of 2006, and I made some incursions to the trip of migrants to wrote some reports for some reviews in Mexico. And I saw that this problem, that this complex problem that migrants suffer in Mexico after the organized crime involved in the trip of migrants discovered that they can get a profit with these undocumented migrants, the story of that people definitely changed and start a new era in the way of the migrants. So I thought in that moment that it was impossible make a coverage just making incursions to the way of the migrants. And I decided with my newspaper, who is elfaro.net, an online newspaper from El Salvador, to start it for 2 years in a house to travel like a migrant in some parts of the way of this horrible trip of the Central American migrants in Mexico. I do that for 2 years and a half in Mexico. We went in the south frontier, we went in the north frontier, and of course, eight times. I say we because I worked with a photographer who called El Ponce. Of course, we made eight trips in the beast, in the train that the migrants take to cross Mexico.
When they ride atop of the train. How did you stay safe?
It's difficult, but I have to be fair with that. I'm not a migrant. I mean, you as a reporter, you can experiment a lot of risk, but you are not a migrant. You are not the hero of your story. I just watched what happened with these people who can't leave that places. I could leave the places of the migration and came back to Mexico City to write and to stay calm for some days or some weeks. These people can do that for 2 or 3 months, can leave that hell. It's impossible. They have to live all the consequences of that hell. I have to say that our technique was very simple. We made investigative journalism, so we need time. The journalists who try to do investigative journalists need time. I think that if you have a good research with you, you're going to be safe because you understand the places where you're going to go. But if the newspaper or the media, like used to do right now in that era of internet and all that possibilities, if they give it to you 2 days or 3 days to make an investigation, that's impossible. You're going to be in danger if you pretend to cover something related with losetas in Mexico and you don't have 2 or 3 months to make your investigation. You're going to be in a huge danger. So we have that prerogative. I had time to get in these places. I had 1 month to prepare my incursions to all the time. So I think that that's the the number one rule of the safety for a journalist.
You had several individuals that you followed, that you interviewed, who were on the migrant trail and who faced really gut-wrenching circumstances. Was there one common theme among those people that you interviewed and met?
Okay, well, I can speak in present, for example. A few minutes ago that we started this interview, I was talking with an old lady, the mother of a migrant who died in 2011 in a huge massacre that Los Zetas perpetrated in the state of Tamaulipas, in the north of Mexico, frontier with Brownsville, Texas. To have an idea of what happened in Mexico, this humanitarian crisis that happened in Mexico, in 2011, this Salvadorian migrant died in a massacre where died 193 migrants of a horrible way, of course, with torture and rapes for the women, etc. I was talking with that lady a few minutes ago after I started this conversation. So in 2007, the rules of the way changed. Los Zetas are a huge band, a huge gang with a lot of connections with the police, with the authorities, with the local authorities of that Mexico that not all the people know. This is not the Mexico of the big cities. This is not the Mexico of the tourists. This is the Mexico of the little towns. This is the Mexico of the little village. This is the Mexico of the very, very, very small towns. So it's the Mexico that you never want to see. It's the Mexico where nobody want to go. It's the Mexico without big newspapers. It's the Mexico without just eight local police officers with one little gang who have to confront a huge armed organization like Los Zetas, no? Like Los Zetas or El Cartel de Sinaloa or El Cartel del Golfo. So it's a very desperate situation. That's what happened in Mexico with that population of migrants.
Let's talk about two aspects of this. First of all, you're talking about Los Zetas, the dangerous gang. Now, one of the things that you wrote about Los Zetas, you said it's really kind of like a metastasizing cancer because it has recruited so many people from so many walks of life into the gang. So almost like you don't even know who's in this gang and who isn't. How do you describe this thing now?
I have to say that one of my frustrations is don't have all the vocabulary to describe Los Zetas in the United States. What Los Zetas do in this road of migrants in Mexico is for me impossible to describe with my very poor English. Los Zetas have the control, have the complete control of some places in Mexico. They are the authorities in some places in Mexico, and I can say it's the name of some of that places: Coatzacoalcos, Apizaco, Tierra Blanca, that's in Veracruz, or for example, Tenosique. I'm talking about Tabasco, the frontier with Guatemala, with the jungle of Petén in Guatemala, the big frontier of the organized crime who want to traffic weapons, who want to traffic girls, who need to traffic, of course, drugs. I can mention, for example, Nuevo Laredo in Tamaulipas, who is a frontier with Laredo in the United States. I can mention Matamoros, who is the frontier with Brownsville, Texas. These places where the migrants need to cross have a complete control by Los Zetas. They have a powerful capacity of fire. I mean, Los Zetas can, for example, I described that in a chapter in the book. Los Zetas can kidnap 100 people in the afternoon in the center of one of these towns when the migrants arrive to these places in the top of the train. They can make that kidnap just in the afternoon with the sun up there, and anybody gonna say that? Anybody say that? Anybody do that? Because this is the most unknown Mexico. This is the Mexico that anybody want to see, because it's not necessary if you need votes, because the migrants never going to denounce with the authorities, because migrants see the authorities in Mexico as the enemy. They are involved with Los Zetas. Of course that they are involved with Los Zetas. So I feel very frustrated, because I need more words to describe to you what happened in that place with Los Zetas.
So, but essentially what you're saying is, in broad daylight, they can kidnap 100 migrants who are trying to escape some bad circumstances in their own hometowns and then put them in worse circumstances. Now, the way you described it in your book, The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging Narcos on the Migrant Trail, was that the primary purpose of the kidnappings is to get a ransom for each of them.
Yeah.
And that has turned into a pretty big business. Give us some numbers.
It's a huge business. Los Zetas want the money that the families of the migrants who live in the United States going to pay to the coyote or to the smuggler when they make the work of cross the border with the United States. That's the money that Los Zetas want. Yeah, talking about $150,000, that's like a comedy. But that's the money that Los Zetas want. And you can think that in 2009, this is not new for the Mexican authorities. I put you an example. In 2009, I mentioned that in one of the chronicles in the book, in the kidnap that don't matter. In 2009, the Human Rights Commission of Mexico made a report. In that report, they interviewed like around 10,000 migrants in Mexico who in those particular moment was in Mexico and trying to get into the United States. The Human Rights Commission of Mexico gave a number of the profits that Los Zetas won just with that 10,000 migrants. And that profit was around $25 million. It's a huge profit for this organization of crime who discovered that they can have something, take something with people who have nothing. It's incredible how they discover the way of extortion. These people leave Central America because they need progress. But Los Zetas discovered that they have relatives or families in the United States, and that changed the story of the migration in Mexico.
Let me first remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're speaking with Oscar Martinez, who has written a book called The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging Narcos on the Migrant Trail, in which he actually went on the migrant trail to find out exactly what was going on. Do you have a sense, based on your stories, you have talked about people being killed, mutilated, enslaved, kidnapped, tortured, or simply just disappeared. Is there anybody that has the numbers of how many people we're talking about in these categories?
There's some estimated, but it's impossible. These people know how to hide themselves on the road in Mexico. They know that if the authorities of the organized crime, if they cross in front of the authorities of the organized crime, they're going to have problems. That's the precedent in Mexico. So that's the reason that these people are not a problem for the Mexican authorities, because they don't denounce. Of course, they don't vote. They are not Mexican people. They don't represent a problem for the Mexican authorities. I think that I always, all the time, say that for me, it's very important that the people read the book in English, republished with Verso Books. It's very important because I think that something has to change in the minds of the people from the United States who deal with migrants from Central America who work in the United States. If they know what happened with that people to arrive to the United States, I think that something has to change in your perception of migrants if you know what happened for 1, 2, or 3 months with that people when they crossed Mexico to get in the United States. Really, I don't like this word, but really, it's a hell. That's a word who can describe that, and it's not a common place to describe something. I think that it's honest in that case say that this wait is a really hell for the migrants.
It takes 2 to 3 months for somebody to go from Central America up through Mexico and up to the U.S. border if they make it that far, and many of them don't. Why do people take the risk? Do they not know what they're going to face? Or is their life at home just that bad that they're willing to face something that could be much worse?
Sister, the Central American government are very responsible with that issue of migration. You have to know that the money that the migrants who live in the United States send to Central America represent a lot of the total money who move in that countries. So the government like the Guatemala or El Salvador or Nicaragua or Honduras prefer to sacrifice his people and not economies. I think that there is no a lot of information here in Central America. The migrants who are the Salvadorian people who are thinking right now to take that road across Mexico for first time, they don't know exactly what happened. And they don't know because migrants who arrived to the United States don't tell the story all the time. I suppose that people feel shame of what happened in the way of Mexico. And of course, Central America is a very difficult place to live. You have to know that Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador are the North Triangle of Central America are the most violent piece of earth. I mean, in percent of homicide, it's a very difficult place to live for the people, for the work class in Central America. But I think you have to remember that the families, the Central, during the wars in the 80s and 90s in Central America, thousands and thousands of Central American people lived the region and go to the United States. So we have a lot of broken families, half family living in Guatemala and half family living in the United States, in Los Angeles, in Washington, in Maryland, in Virginia. So they want to get together again. That's one of the reasons. But I think that the principal reason, it's a very normal and understanding reason. It's the need of progress or think that your life is not going to be all the time wake up at 5 in the morning and go to a work to receive a very, very ridiculous payment for that work who make you live in the poverty. And you don't want that for your kids, and you don't want that for your family. And there is a construction, I think that a wrong construction, but there is a construction since a lot of years that in the United States you can change that way, you can change that condition. So it's the need of progress. Think that there is something else in the life that the need like power can give anything to your child. I think that is very normal situation.
So one of the numbers that you gave in your book said that something like 6 out of 10 migrants are kidnapped. Does that include, for example, the young women that you interviewed that became trafficked into sex slavery?
Yeah, that happened. That's an estimated made by the Senate in Mexico. That's one of the most hard situation. If the migrants from Central America across Mexico are a very vulnerable population, the women into that population are more, but much, much more vulnerable because organized crime, mostly in the kidnaps, the target on weapons, because they can sell women to brothels in the North Frontier for, it's not much money, but if you sell a lot of, that represent good profit, like $1,500, you can buy a woman in the North Frontier of Mexico. So yes, the aggression, the sexual harassment to women in other places where it's not the organized crime, it's just a normal thieves who are in the hiding places that migrants cross in Mexico. It's very common. They know that that's going to happen today in Mexico, and they assume that they're going to be raped in Mexico. if it's already a normal situation, we think that, or migrants wrongly think that this is normal, and they assume that that's going to happen.
You also interviewed the Border Patrol in Arizona. What was your sense about that? After those interviews, what did you see? What was your realization?
I think that the United States know that it's impossible to stop migration. It's impossible. But the United States, the government, needs to have an strategic control of the frontier. But as the people that I meet in the Border Patrol in the sector of Tucson, Arizona, who is the huge base of the Border Patrol in the frontier, they understand themselves, an institution who fight against terrorism. They didn't find his first responsibility with migrant detentions or migrant issues. That's like the second thing in interest. See, yeah, tell me.
Looking at this now, you've interviewed all types of people who have faced some of the worst circumstances that a human being could possibly face. And we don't even know the whole story because so many of these migrants who are kidnapped and disappeared, there's no record anywhere of it. Given what you've seen and given the interviews that you did, both with the migrants and with the Border Patrol and with officials, how does one even start to come up with some kind of solution to this problem? It's so massive.
I think I have to know that I'm a very pessimistic guy, but I think that first at all, as a journalist, I have to say that talk about this situation is one of the steps to a change. I went in the United States last month, and I went in Washington, for example, yesterday, even as this. People in the United States don't really know about what happened with Central American migrants who arrived to the United States. In fact, they call us Mexicanos. I mean, it's like a generalization. All the people who came from Latin America are from Mexico. No, these people, before arrived to the United States, crossed the hell. It's different. I know that Mexican migrants have tough situations, but this is different. I mean, Mexico is a huge country to cross. But I think that talk about, publish about this issue in the United States is very important because it's a humanitarian crisis with Biden in Mexico. And second, let me see if I can pronounce that, if I find the correct words to say that. I think that Mexico have to create some precedent, making trials against these groups of Zetas or these groups of guys in Mexico who do that to the Central American migrants. If the message continue that if you do something with migrants who cross Mexico, never gonna happen with you, that's gonna continue happen. I mean, why Los Zetas or why the little groups of criminals going to stop if there is not a precedent on a trial on the justice system of Mexico? Why are you gonna stop anything happen? There is no consequences. I think that Mexico have to create that precedent to show to these organizations that something can happen if you do all that tortures, rape, and kidnaps to a population who just went across your country. I think that this is very important, and I think that both things have a relation. I think that publish and talk about the topic going to create the pressure for the Mexican authorities who have to create this precedent in the justice system, who send that message that something's going to happen. But right now, anything happened. I mean, for the massacre in 2011 of 193 Central American migrants and some Mexican migrants too, there is nobody in jail. Nobody was in a trial for that. There is no arrest. So the message is very clear. Do whatever you want because anything's going to happen. That's what I think that can help to check this situation.
Oscar Martinez, I want to thank you very much for your work and for sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Oscar Martinez is an award-winning journalist and author of The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging Narcos on the Migrant Trail. When we come back, what sustains and empowers social movements? What destroys them? Up next, stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How have social movements changed in the 21st century, and have new communication technologies facilitated change? What makes some social movements sustainable and successful, while others are more short-term? What is the future for social movements? With us are three experts. James Jasper is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. His books include Protest, A Cultural Introduction to Social Movements, The Art of Moral Protest, and The Social Movements Reader. Anita Lacey also joins us. Anita Lacey is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland. She's the co-author of Governing the Poor and Transnational Activism and Social Change. Todd Wolfson is also with us. He is a professor of journalism and media studies and the digital media coordinator for the MCIS program at Rutgers University. He's the author of Digital Rebellion and the co-author of The Great Refusal. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here. What I wanted to start with is a definition that distinguishes social movements from, say, protests or other acts to bring people together or make social change. Jim Jasper, would you like to start?
Protest is a major component of social movements. We call them protest movements, in fact. But social movements have a little bit more to them than individual protest events, marches and rallies and so on. They build up some organizations. They build up networks of people who know each other. So they persist over time, unlike, say, one particular rally or one particular occupation. So they bring a lot more depth to them, and they gather some resources that they can use. They rent buildings and so on. They take out ads. They do more than simply march down the street.
Can you give some examples that would help us to draw distinctions? What would be something that used protests but wouldn't be a social movement?
Let's look at the environmental movement, which is a good example. They use protests, they have Earth Day, they get people out into the street, but they also at the same time do a lot of legal work. They build up, they promote alternative energies. They do a lot of work that's not particularly protesting something, but actually trying to construct an alternative in a way. I think that's the best way to think about a social movement as opposed to a protest.
Anita Lacey?
I would agree with Jim. I think it's about the sustained nature of protest in a social movement, as well as that idea of a network of people coming together in a variety of activities. So you might have a single protest about, say, animal rights, but that protest would then be situated within a broader social movement. So it's quite difficult to separate the two. And often where we see a protest, if we dig, there's a social movement behind it, but not necessarily.
Todd Wolfson?
Yeah, I think they've really nailed. The place I would go to bring it to life would be right now, an example in the United States I think is very useful, is the Black Lives Matter movement, which at first, when you first looked at it, it was a form of protest and resistance to a particular set of conditions that took place, you know, the shooting of Michael Brown and the lack of a grand jury conviction, and the same with Eric Garner in New York City. But as we've seen it grow, we've seen a set of sustained forms of resistance and organizations that are becoming the backbone of the movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, which also may change name. So just on MLK Day across the United States, you saw something called Reclaim MLK Day, which was a series of protests in multiple cities organized by different types of movement organizations. And I think that you see the transition from resistance and protest to what's beginning to look like, and it is not there yet, I would be clear, but I think we're beginning to see what is a sustained social movement. So it's just a transitory moment that helps us outline some of what makes a movement distinct.
Do you get a sense of how 21st century social movements are different from those in the past?
Yes. In my research, I think what comes clear is that they're very different. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be parochial, but at least in the United States, historians are going to mark a set of historical kind of left-based action, the old left being the first half of the 20th century, the new left being the 60s and 70s, with the civil rights being a bridge between these two. And I think if you look at the ways movements were organized in those periods and push them up against what we've seen from, say, the Zapatistas in the late 90s through to the early 2000s and into the contemporary moment, you see a very different logic. Much more of a focus on prefigurative politics, much more of a focus on direct forms of democracy, a much more interlinked role of social media and networks. I would say, unfortunately, much less of a strong analysis of class and capitalism, but I think we've seen a very big transition in how social movements operate.
Jim Jasper.
I don't mean to disagree with Todd, but I think what we see is we have new media. We're doing new tools for doing the same things that social movements have always done. They've always built networks. They've always recruited people. Now they recruit people. They build those networks through the internet, through Facebook, I suppose, rather than going door to door canvassing or hanging out at the local bar to recruit people for the labor movement. And social movements have always been about pulling people together, attracting new people to the cause, getting the message out, coordinating activities through communication. Communications have improved gradually over time. The internet's the most recent. Cell phones are the most recent twist. But there was a big step forward in the 19th century when cheap newspapers were available to be distributed. So there's a long history of improving communications, improving coordination that social movements have taken advantage of.
Anita Lacey, would you agree?
I would agree. I think one of the changes has been a fluidity and a quicker means of assemblage and disorganization. So you see movements come together perhaps a little bit more quickly in response to events. But as Jim has said, this has always happened. So if perceived injustice occurred, then people would assemble and activate against that. But we're also more aware of it because of new media. So I think there both have been changes, particularly around how we communicate to protest and to be active and to network, as well as new media's role in reporting that both to activists but also non-activists.
With the role of new media, I see a couple things that are kind of opposing forces, it seems. One is that while there's removing part of the middle person, the journalist, so people can directly frame the movement the way they'd like to and articulate things the way they want, communicate with their network in the ways that they would like. At the same time, I wonder if there's a danger of what people are calling clicktivism, meaning this shallow form of participation that doesn't get people involved outside of clicking on their preferred petition. Todd Wolfson, what do you think about that?
I think you make a really good point. I want to mark one thing first, which is it's not so much social media that has changed social movements in contemporary moment. It's a logic of how activists operate, which is co-determined by social media. But if you look at the way the Communist Party of the United States of America, or the AFL-CIO, or the CIO in particular, was organized in structures in the first half of the 20th century, and if you look at the way the Direct Action Network, or the organizations at the core of the global social justice movement, or even Occupy, organize themselves, and the social horizons they fight towards today, I think you see a sea change in the logic of activism that may have some parallelism to the social media, but isn't about social media per se. We shouldn't overstress social media, but that doesn't mean there hasn't been a change in how people think about what they're doing. And I do think there's a deep danger with, quote, clicktivism. I think that actually, if we look at social media and we look at the movements in the last 20 years, what we see is an over-reliance on technology. And what that's led to is people with social and cultural capital tend to take a lead in these movements because they're the most proficient in technology. And so you see movements that are much more led by a white, middle-class, college-educated men who have proficiency in how to create computer programs or create a video. And also this other dangers of collectivism, that it's an easy way to engage but not a deep way to engage, which I think you were marking. I think both of those are real dangers that we're seeing emerge in contemporary activism because of the role of social media.
Jim Jasper?
I've taught courses on social movements probably for 30 years now. And it was just 3 or 4 years ago, for the first time, I had more men than women in the class. And I think this represents a shift away from movements about collective identity, women's movement, obviously, but also the LGBTQ sets of movements. Also movements like a lot of the environmental movement and animal rights, heavily dominated by women. And I think what the Occupy movement represents, especially, is a turn toward economic issues, economic injustice, and a much more belligerent, pugnacious, aggressive set of tactics, I think, that still to this day attract more men than women. So that's certainly a change in the last few years that I've noted.
What about the gendered aspect, Anita Lacey?
So I'm putting on my activist hat now, but I would say there's always been a tendency for the male ego warrior as opposed to the eco warrior, who sees activism as a forum in which to express perhaps a sense of ability to change and an ability to dominate, unfortunately. That's challenged, but not always effectively, and certainly over the last 20 years, so preceding Occupy, and this would go back to my own background in Australia. You know, we've been fighting male dominance within activist circles, both from, you know, the eco-anarchist circle, some even LGBTQ circles and counter-capital circles, that yes, there is a dominance of some white young men who believe they've got the answers. And I think that's quite common in many Western activist circles. And I do agree that we've seen a shift after Occupy, perhaps in a heightened sense of the role of the male activist linked to technology, but of course not only about that role.
Yeah. I think that raises another question, which is the very purpose of social movements and the definitions of success. I've always argued that the civil rights movement is unparalleled in terms of success. They won laws, culture, identity. They changed the fabric of a nation on every level. And I haven't seen very many movements since then succeed. Maybe the marriage equality one is going there. But I think I saw, Jim Jasper, in your work that maybe this is not always the goal. Maybe this is not, what would you say defines success and the purpose of social movement?
I think most social movements are indeed trying to change public policy. On the other hand, most movements fail at that. As kind of a second best, they often turn to, well, we're going to influence culture, we're going to influence public attitudes, we're going to find smaller successes. Mobilizing the movement itself becomes a form of success. If we can mobilize a big movement, get a lot of people out, that's taken as a form of success, whatever the broader impact. Especially scholars who study social movements want to find success. They want to think that the movements they study are important. So they look around for all sorts of types of success to do so. The civil rights movement plays a big role in scholars' images of what a social movement is. Frankly, the civil rights movement is every white scholar's favorite movement. There's less consensus among black scholars who actually may not love the Martin Luther King blue-coated preachers movement of the SCLC. But for white Americans, this is the great movement where everybody came together. you could say that we still have a long way to go on race in America, especially as Tom mentioned with the Black Lives Matter movement. The civil rights issues come up again and again and again and have never gone away. As far as success, I think you're right. Same-sex marriage as a movement has been remarkably successful in a very short amount of time. I would say that the women's movement has also been incredibly successful in an even shorter length of time than we've had the civil rights movements. There certainly are successful movements. There are not enough of them, perhaps. What has happened also in the last generation is that it's really the right wing that has been more successful at mobilizing in the United States than people on the left liberal end of the spectrum. That's something that has changed a bit in the last few years. But since the 1970s, if you wanted to see really successful mobilization, it tended to be among the Christian religious right.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the evolution of social movements. Todd Wolfson, let's bring you in. You looked at some examples like indie media, which you think had lasting influence, but in the short term was sort of a failure. How would you assess social movements' success?
I think James really marked some really excellent points about what success we've seen, and I agree that most of the time, the real goal is a change in policy. You know, a change that actually affects the lives of human beings who are, you know, being organized into movements or are doing the organizing. And all too often, we haven't seen that. And I looked at the global social justice movement, and what I tended to see was this tenuous balance between what we prefigurative politics, right? Changing the structures within the movement to resemble the kind of world you want to see, which often led to a set of obstacles that the activists who were often quite young didn't know how to deal with in actually enacting the change they wanted to see. And so there was a strong, certainly in indie media, there was a tension between living the world you want to see versus being able to build a strategy that enacts the change you want to see. And I think many times activists will then move very closely towards prefiguration because I'm not going to say it's more comfortable, but it leads to a place where we could say, well, at least we didn't create structures of hierarchy or certain sort of gender dominance or et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think indie media was successful in creating the changes it aimed to enact, but I do think it was successful in other ways.
Anita Lacey.
I would agree with both of you that the movements I've looked at tend to be autonomous, small-scale movements and collectives as part of that global social justice network. And they're not necessarily seeking the sort of instrumental policy change in the immediate. And so success for them can simply be about a functioning, non-hierarchical collective and fostering that collective identity and the pursuit of a greater range of causes and building a network and perhaps slow change. But I also believe that we can mark successive movements by looking at more instrumental change, you know, policy change, and would agree that the three sort of success stories of the 20th century would probably also include a fourth, which could be the environmental movement, and of course a fifth, which would be the right, and they're ongoing. So their success has reached an end point because, you know, we don't live in a world free of racial injustice. We don't live in a world of no patriarchy, et cetera, but they have certainly reached a level of success.
Jim Jasper.
I think all social movements face a little bit of a trade-off between how much attention to pay to their own internal membership and their own internal functioning and how much attention and time to pay to other players out there, governments and media and the police and so on. And when things go bad for a movement, very often they sort of turn inward for a while and they spend a lot of time making their own members feel good about being members of the movement. But while that maintains their commitment, it also doesn't get anything done in the real world. So I think a lot of people who were frustrated with the Occupy movement were frustrated with it partly because of the General Assembly and the internal procedures. And, you know, it's a trade-off. It's a dilemma. There's no right answer. You need a little bit of both, the internal and the external.
Jim Jasper, you also wrote about the importance of meaning-making and emotions. And how do these come into play?
Emotions come in at all stages of a social movement. Emotions help people get involved, get recruited. It's the anger, the indignation they feel about some injustice in the world that is at the core of why they join social movements. But then there are other emotions. They may be afraid if they're intimidated by the police. They may be bored and stop coming to demonstrations for those reasons. They may simply be tired. It may be that the emotions they feel for their families. So emotions bring people into social movements as well as bringing them out again.
Anita Lacey?
I would agree. Obviously, emotions core, if we think about one of the core goals being our collective sense of belonging, or maybe it's not a goal, but it's certainly a mode of operation and can become a focus point of a movement. So obviously emotions and the way in which people communicate, the way in which people respond to difficult times, people's goals and aspirations and hopes, these are key, I think, to understanding social movements, and perhaps that there are different types of social movements with different ideas of success, different focuses, and probably going back to that point you made, Jim, about at some times movements will retreat and focus on an inner dynamic as opposed to their relationships with formal police and the state, etc. I do think it's important to recognize that there are some groups, some social movements that will never seek to engage with the state or police in the way that other groups might. So they don't see their goal as having a good functioning relationship with police or the state. So to me, that's one of the important sort of ideas about social movements, is that we don't try and judge them all against those formal policy-seeking sort of movements, this American civil rights movement, for example. And that even within that, there was, as you've said, a lot of dissent about how to operate, what the best modes of operation are, hierarchy, leadership, etc.
Or leaderlessness, as we saw in some of these movements that Todd Wolfson has been writing about. That leads me to another aspect, and Todd, you did a bit of this in your book, which is how these social movements learn from each other and how social media has expedited this ability to learn from one another, influence one another, and maybe even building more of a global solidarity. Todd Wolfson?
One thing I looked at in particular was the Zapatistas. So the Zapatista movement that started in 94 on the day the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect.
For people who don't know, the Zapatistas, just say a little bit about Chiapas and Mexico and why they started.
Absolutely. So they emerged on the day the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect. It was largely, though not entirely, Mayan peasants in the southernmost state of Mexico, Chiapas, which is one of the most resource-rich, but one of the poorest states. And they rose up because when the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect, they said it was a death knell to their way of life as subsistence farmers, particularly because agribusiness in the United States and cheap corn would flood markets and make their way of living impossible. And so they rose up, they took over a host of towns and the capital of Chiapas on January 1st. And then there was an ensuing struggle between them and the Mexican state, which they honestly weren't fully prepared for. And they were retreating into the mountains, and the Mexican army was pursuing them when they turned to the internet in an interesting way, amongst other things, and they were able to get a peace accord. And there's a lot to that story that can be looked at, but I guess what I really wanted to understand was how the logic of the Zapatistas became a kind of a fundamental ideological stone in which the whole global social justice movement sort of kind of measured itself up against. And so many of the things that they kind of thought through, such as direct democracy, which has a long Mayan history, or networks, which were these, the way they kind of organized themselves in these caracoles or these communities that they lived in, or the role of social media, then became central concepts that activists in the global social justice movement utilized. And I would mark these ideas moved from Mexico northward, I would say largely, and then across to Europe as well. There's a problem with that, though, because land-based Mayan peasants developing a certain set of logics and then transferring those logics to a global, largely middle-class movement in the U.S. and Canada has serious problems, not to mention that people in North America took what I think was a very flexible strategy of the Zapatistas and turned it into orthodoxy. So people weren't like, it must be direct democracy at all times, when the Zapatistas had a mixture of a hierarchical army and democratic processes and communities. But I do think that the logics that emerged out of the Zapatistas were extremely influential in the global social justice movement, and I would say secondarily influential in the more recent wave of protests from the quote-unquote Arab Spring to Occupy.
And maybe then you saw an abundance of additional protests that have arisen in the 21st century, including Hong Kong calling themselves Occupy. Anita Lacey?
I think what we can take from looking at the role of networks, particularly in the on Cuantros and the meetings around the Zapatista struggle and in solidarity with the Zapatista struggle and also a larger network of anti-neoliberal struggles, is something that recognizes a long-standing history of networking and newer forms of. And I think this goes back to the earlier point of overstating the role of new media, because we can see that the internet played a really fundamental role in the 1990s in the global social justice movement, but it didn't organize people. It wasn't the only tool that brought people together. What brought people together was a sense of urgency around free trade agreements, urgency around global poverty and social injustice, and a sort of connection with each other globally, but of course also built around the local. And we saw a momentum emerge from the early 1990s right through to 2001, when of course things fundamentally changed and we entered into a counter-terror period, but also an anti-war period. And so those networks were then built on and changed again, building on the local and a sense of global. One of my points of interest in looking at this period is the role of the Global South and how we took a movement from Mexico. It quickly became quite North-dominated, but led to really interesting relationships between activists in the Global North with activists from the Global South. So things like the Intercontinental Caravan that brought activists from India to Britain to look at the legacy of colonialism on trade relations, but also how to forge a more inclusive global social movement. And I think those questions still remain. I think there's a lot of work to be done. And I think the example of Occupy Hong Kong really reminds me of just how sort of both problematic and hopeful this is. You know, that we see students taking this label, literally direct occupying the street in this strange sort of place of post-colonialism and new colonialism, but that we need critical reflection at all times about how we're using these labels, how we ascribe success to new social media and new media, given lack of access in a global sense to this new media as a sort of forum and mechanism of organizing.
Okay. Really important points. Jim Jasper.
Well, I think the global justice movement is a great example that shows why or how new technologies and good old-fashioned face-to-face networking and meetings always work together. There's a lot of new media that were used to, in the end, bring people to the World Social Forums, 100,000, 150,000 people. They weren't satisfied with staying at home and Skyping with each other. There's an energy you get from being together in the same place at the same time. The same with North Africa, with Tunisia and Egypt. You don't bring down governments until you go out into the streets. You can use Facebook and new media to coordinate those gatherings. But in the end, you've got to bring people together.
Todd Wolfson?
I completely agree with Jim, and I think those are really important statements. And I think, for instance, the indie media movements, one of the reasons it didn't operate well in the long term was because of an over-reliance on technology that moved away from the local and moved away from the streets. One other thing I guess I would mark is I think there needs to be a balance moving forward between the meme around leaderlessness and a belief in building leaders. And by that, I mean that in order to build movements, I think the ones that have been most successful have been committed to programs where people do political education together, they get clear, competent, committed, and connected. And these sort of things are very hard to build in movements that are fearful of leadership and want to lead with the meme of leaderlessness. And so it's something we really need to balance moving forward, because leaderlessness, I think, once again, tends to favor those with the most social and cultural capital, and also doesn't bring all of us up into a movement and build the skills to help lead that movement. So it's an important question I think we need to tackle moving forward.
Anything you'd like to add, Anita?
I just concur with both Jim and Todd and say that I think we're going to see a lot of ongoing activism and potentially new networks between race, climate, and poverty. I mean, this is the global social justice movement's moment, just as it has been previously, but that perhaps we will see new networks and coalitions of activists around the ways in which these issues intersect in very powerful ways. But it will take place through a combination of new media, but essentially also on the street.
Let me thank the three of you, Anita Lacey, James Jasper, Todd Wolfson. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. James Jasper is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. His books include Protest, A Cultural Introduction to Social Movements, The Art of Moral Protest, and The Social Movements Reader. Anita Lacey is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland. She's the co-author of Governing the Poor and Transnational Activism and Social Change. Todd Wolfson is professor of journalism and media studies and the digital media coordinator for the MCIS program at Rutgers University. He's the author of Digital Rebellion and the co-author of The Great Refusal. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Cuauhtemoc Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.